Dr. Kerrigan, a mathematician, studies comets, asteroids, and their effect on the climate of the Earth.
It's an honor and a pleasure to be here. The title of my talk is Extraterrestrial Objects, Impact Events and Other Effects on Earth. By way of introduction, a colleague of mine, a mentor of mine, and I have been investigating various phenomena in the atmosphere and outside the atmosphere for about 40 years. And recently, within the past 5 years or so, it seems that all of these have sort of disparate studies have sort of come together into a unified view of extraterrestrial effects, in particular the arrival of water vapor and particles at the top of the atmosphere, and a potential significant effect with regard to the control or influence on weather and climate.
Excuse me, Doctor, could you focus the projector a little bit? We've been pushing the knob on the side. That's it. Much better.
Okay. This is a technical talk. My goal and my duty is to make it human understandable. But with regard to focusing the slides, I'm afraid that what you're going to see when they're focused is what we still call an eye chart. These charts are not for your benefit, they're for mine. Okay. So I will talk to the charts, but please don't labor yourselves with trying to read most of this stuff up here. This is just the text of the talk I'll put on paper and make available, you know, in some form or other in appropriate time. In any case, I presented a talk here about 2 years ago, and the premise of the talk was that the annual formation of the ozone hole over Antarctica was not caused by anthropogenic chlorofluorocarbons, that's freon, right? It was caused instead by, this is all hypothetical, by the way. I'm not here because I know God's absolute truth, but I'm following the data as we saw it, and there are reasons for the alternative theory. The ozone hole was caused by the arrival of exoterrestrial or extraterrestrial particles that John Rosinski had discovered in the course of sampling in the atmosphere about 30 years earlier. And I was working with John at this time, and you know, he was enamored of these particles, but they were a solution looking for a problem. Now, the problem came along about 30 years later, the appearance of the ozone hole, and there were enormous coincidences that enabled us to hook these together and suggest that this was the cause of the ozone hole formation. There were two problems. There are a number of problems with our particular theory, that is, issues that needed to be retired. Two of the issues were that there are two ozone holes, and generally speaking, extraterrestrial arrivals, that is, the particles, such as meteor showers, hit the Earth at most once a year, not twice a year. But if these are the cause of the ozone hole, and there's an ozone hole formation at South Pole in the polar southern spring, right, and in the North Pole 6 months later, that's asking an awful lot of the arrival of these extraterrestrials with regard to synchronicity. Twice a year is about twice as much as we had any right to expect from what we understood of the mechanics of the solar system. We had to deal with that in the theory. We also had to deal with the fact that these particles were sampled for during a lot of AEC sampling of inadvertent fallout during air burst nuclear tests during the 50s, and everything was sampled from the ground gopher level up. And there were no such particles, none discovered. Yet the same techniques in the late 60s yielded an abundance of these particles just at the right time to sort of fortify our theory. So there was this abrupt onset of the annual arrival of the particles. This is still by way of introduction. I don't want to dwell on the ozone hole issue, except that it raised certain possibilities for us. It's not so much the ozone hole I'd like to focus on, but things that we've learned as we've addressed this ozone hole issue, which is unfinished business. I think we have found that comets cannot provide an explanation for the arrival of these particles. If you'll notice, there's a list at the top of this page of some of the comets that we see. Associated meteor showers. These comets produce meteor showers because as they get to the interplanetary region within the orbit of Jupiter, they slough off debris in the form of boulders or tiny particles or all sorts of chemical debris. Ultraviolet radiation blows apart the molecules, the naked molecules, and there's some vicious, vicious forces out there. Space is not a free ride. It's an awful place. And the showers associated, right, with these comets have been associated for at least, I think starting about 160 years ago, people conceived the notion that the two are related. And this list is a kind of mapping between the more prominent comets, more visible and regular, the corresponding showers, and the annual occurrence of the brightest shower activity associated with the comets. And you'll notice that there are two showers, that is, there are two comets, each of which has two showers. And this is what I was looking for in the ozone hole north and south. It's just that the prominent contributors, that is Halley's Comet, Comet Halley and Comet Encke, produce showers that arrive, hit the Earth's upper atmosphere at just the wrong dates. Unfortunately, it was a good idea. It doesn't work. I think the explanation is that about 1966, we reckon, more or less 5 years, what we came to understand is that there is an alternate explanation. The source of these particles that we were sampling is derived from the collision on the backside. Is sound. You know, there are a lot of strange ideas in this talk. So if you think this is strange, I mean, you're right with me. The particles could be produced by the collision of a small comet on the backside of the moon. When the comet hits the moon at a high rate of speed, 35 kilometers a second, for example, there's a terrible explosion. It's very hot and violent, and it blows all kinds of debris, mostly microscopic, into solar orbit. These particles go off in all sorts of different directions, somewhere between 8 and 10 kilometers a second. They orbit the sun. And the strange thing, if you do the orbit mechanics, is not only does each orbit return to the point of origin, not every year, but the same point, no matter what its periodicity is. And there are a lot of different periods because they take a lot of different directions and velocities. They come back every year or to the same spot. Some of them come back sooner, some later, some at the right time to re-intercept Earth when the Earth is there. But the interesting thing about the orbit mechanics, when you do the calculations, is that they also hit the diametrically opposite point in abundance. It's just a little quirk of, you know, the mechanics that you read if you do physics undergraduate level. So this offered an explanation for the rapid onset of the annual event. We got them in the 60s, but not the 50s, and the requirement that they arrive every year and the arrivals be spaced, you know, upper, lower hemispheres, and the arrivals be spaced every 6 months. So we're satisfied with that, except that it starts to raise some questions. Why didn't we see the comet if it was a comet? Why didn't we see this son of a gun? It was dark. It was inactive. It didn't produce the normal atmosphere huge that glows and enables us to spot the thing easily. Undiscovered, quiet, stealthy. There's also another similar possible event. It's the Tunguska effect, or event. 1908, in Siberia, something wonderful happened. There was evidently an atmospheric explosion. A lot of megatons up there, a lot of flat trees. If you consult the internet, you'll find there's a lot of mysticism surrounding this event. There's still annual meetings with regard to some reputable and some mystical scientists who are channeling little green men. It's a wonderful meeting, I'm sure. No one knows yet what this was. The best guess, 30 years after the event and 20 years after it was investigated on the ground, it's a remote area, is that it was a comet, quiet, stealthy, entered the atmosphere, disintegrated, and it brought a lot of energy with it, and it leveled a lot of trees. There's no crater on the ground. A lot of action in the atmosphere, but no crater in the ground. So what I'm saying is stealthy events, quiet, dark, stealthy comets, they're arriving, they're inactive, they're hard to see, they're not that big, although if they hit a city, it would be catastrophic. They disintegrate in the air. The hypothesis is that we got these quiet things coming. To a century, that's pretty good. The statistics are a bit of a stretch here. But there are other events similar to this that have received less attention. They're not quite as large. They don't produce as much energy. But the question is, for the purpose of this talk, what's the hazard from the arrival of this sort of stuff? We know that there are comets out there, and they're headed our way, comets and asteroids. The comets, by the way, are full of water. That separates them in the most primitive sense from the asteroids, which are full of rock. In any case, the question is, for my purposes, the overall issue in the long term is the arrival of stuff, not just the big things, comets and asteroids, but the smaller particles, the influence on weather and climate. But for the purpose of this talk, I think the question is to clarify the life cycle of comets. Where do the little guys come from, and why aren't they bright and brilliant and recognizable from a distance so we can see them coming, like the ones we can already see? Is the Earth going to get whacked by a comet? And the question is, how much is it going to hurt? I think the answer is we're going to get whacked by a comet, and I don't know how much it's going to hurt. I think, knowing what I think we found out, it may not hurt that much, but I, you know, depending upon where you're standing. I can't answer the question, but I can tell you what I've seen in the data and theories that may help to interpret it. And, of course, you'll form your own conclusions, and I say this is work in progress. Okay, so to level set here just a bit, I've copped from the Internet the Table of Terrors. And I've engaged in this sort of statistical shenanigans myself. People get a few data points, and then they fit them with the straight lines or whatever kind of lines they want to fit with, and they interpolate. And I'm not a statistician. I'm a probabilist. It deals with the issue of integrity. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to knock anybody's profession, but the role of the statistician is to make the best guess about empirical data, which has not been explained yet. So it's the first step in science. And I believe the statisticians produced this schedule for how bad things were going to be. The frequency of impactors that concerns us, a 50-meter rock that would wipe out an area the size of New Jersey arrives once a century. That may be a bit of a stretch. And what they may be talking about, and I don't know how this was derived, was those quiet comets that may be arrived, they may be this size, they may be considerably larger, and they may disintegrate in the atmosphere and never reach us in the first place. It'd be nice to know how many are coming, if indeed they're coming, so forth and so on. So this is a general investigation of that. The outline for the talk, enough introduction. The outline for the talk is, I think, relatively simple. And as I say, I'm trying to make the technical pieces human understandable. That's my goal. And hold me to that, please. I'd like to tell you about the salient features of large comets. Then I'd like to tell you about the probable existence of a class of what are called small comets that were first announced by a group at University of Iowa, in 1996. And the existence of these continues to be enormously controversial. I calculate the rate at which the large comets and these University of Iowa small comets crash into one another during an orbit of a large comet. Two in particular, Comet Halley and Comet Borelli. These are the two comets for which we have flown by with satellites, taken pictures, observed the size of the nucleus, right, is the center of that huge coma, that glowing ball. The center is a solid object, discrete solid object. And when we look at it during a flyby, what we see is that the stuff coming off is not coming off like an ice cube, slowly subliming the way an ice cube does, you know, on the sidewalk in August. Stuff gets out of the comet mostly in the form of violent jets spewing dust and gas, completely unexpected. And it was first observed conclusively in 1986. But then in the year 2000, we flew by Comet Borelli at the end of Deep Space One lifetime, its last gasp, enormously well-performing satellite. And we saw the same thing. These guys have these jets, and that's how they lose mass. What I'd like to propose is a theory of these jets. The first calculation I did shows, this was on a whim, I had no idea this would work out. If you use what we know or suspect about the arrival of the small comets in the atmosphere, and then you calculate, create a model, a plausible model for where these small comets are in the atmosphere, and then you look at the orbits of these two big comets, the small comets hit the big comets in approximately these proportions. You count the number of jets on Comet Halley, 20 or so. You count the number of impacts over the course of its orbit, 20 or so. Fly by Comet Borelli. Count the number of jets, 3. Then you calculate the number of impacts as Comet Borelli goes around the sun in one orbit, 3. Maybe there's a connection. Next thing I did was a calculation that shows what happens when a small comet, very flimsy, it's only 30 tons. It's only 30 tons. When a small comet hits a big comet at the rate of, in the case of Comet Halley, at the rate of, on average, 90,000 miles an hour. So it's 30 tons of flimsy stuff, but boy, is it going fast. And the physics of that is really interesting. I'm going to dwell a little bit about on the physics of when one thing hits another going really, really fast, because the structure, the crater structure that's left is very interesting. It gives rise to the structure of the craters that we think we see on the surface of these comets, some special features in the wells of these craters, the jets in particular. There's a little theory here for how the jets are produced, and the fact that these jets cycle like geysers. They're strong, they go weak, strong, weak, once every 2 or 3 hours. Given this theory, all these calculations have something to do with what's really going on out there, and I like the theory. It just feels good to me quantitatively. That tells us a bit about what happens to comets during the end stage of their life cycles. When they get too small to be impacted at a significant rate, they go dormant. There's nothing keeping them, sustaining them in their activity. And so they don't vaporize to nothing. They leave the solar system one of two ways. We've eliminated the third, vaporizing to nothing. They can either execute a random walk among the planets, you know, under the usual influence of classical gravitational theory, and they fly out of the solar system. These comets are unstable for the most part. They fly out of the solar system, we never see them again. Or they can crash into something. Us. So that's the gist of the talk. There may be objects of this sort. We may be crashing into them, or they into us. It's all relative. But they're made of gas rather than rock. They're rather flimsy. They disintegrate in the atmosphere. So that might put a new light on the actual hazard of these table of terrors compiled by I don't know whom. But this is the consensus view. So the first step, a comet generally consists of a number of parts. There's a discrete nucleus inside an atmosphere called the coma. And the nucleus can be 5-10 kilometers. The coma can be 500,000 kilometers. So when you look at a comet, you're looking at its glowing atmosphere. You have no idea in that region where the nucleus is. It should be at the center, but they're often over to the side quite a bit. So when you're trying to plot the orbit of a comet, you know, which is controlled by the position of this nucleus that gives the atmosphere, it's a little bit hard to pin it down. Solar radiation strikes the comet. This is ice under the influence of UV radiation. It's hazardous out there. And this stuff, the gas, comes off quickly, right? It erodes. This is the conventional view, the consensus view. The ice is exposed to the radiation, and the ice sublimes, right? It vaporizes. And it carries the dust and other debris embedded in the ice off with it. The gas that comes off ionizes, not all of it, but a large portion of it, and produces this ion trail that's captured by the solar wind and carted off to who knows where, you know, the far end of the solar system. The remainder is dust, so that there are, loosely speaking, two tails for a comet. Sometimes they're hard to see. This is Comet West. It's the darling. This is the supermodel of comets. This is the pure picture. It was discovered or asserted in 1950. Excellent theory. Very hard to refute. Excellent theory. There is a mass of these snowballs beyond the Earth between 30,000 and 50,000 astronomical units. An astronomical unit is the distance more or less between the Sun and the Earth. So they're 30,000 to 50,000 times farther out. And they're in orbit around the Sun. But they're going kind of slow because the Sun's very far away and the influence of its gravity is weak. So they go slow. And they orbit the Sun about once every 6 million years. And the total mass of these things adds up to be about, maybe a tenth of the mass of the Earth, maybe a fourth. And there are 100 billion of them. And the size ranges probably between 1 kilometer and 100 kilometers. There are a lot of them, and they're wandering around. Every once in a while, a passing star, according to Oort, who conceived this theory, and it's beautifully supported by the data, according to Oort, what happens is about every 100,000 years a star passes by. And its gravitational influence is such that it perturbs these orbits, and a few of them appear in the solar system, close enough to the Sun within the orbit of Jupiter so that they outgas, form a coma, it glows, and we can see them. Not very many of them. Out there, they are very widely, 100 billion in that vast region of space, you know, of that volume. They're very thinly spaced, right? And a passing star maybe injects, 10 or 12, 18, 20, 3,000, 4,000, But a very slight perturbation will cause these guys to dip down a bit, and we see them. And so we have the appearance of these new comets about twice a year. Right? And they're generally pretty far from us, but that's okay. Recently, we've had a flyby. You may have seen the news recently, Comet Vilt 2. It's creating a big stir and a lot of media interest. In this particular comet, I've got an orbit diagram here. There's the Sun at the center. You can see Jupiter at the bottom on the big circle. You can see Mars halfway in, next circle, closer to the Sun. And you can see off to the lower left the representation for Vilt 2. This comet, until 1974, was orbiting beyond Jupiter only slightly. But it didn't come closer. One day it happened to chance closer to Jupiter, within about 0.006, the distance from Jupiter to the Sun, pretty close. Jupiter's gravity grabbed it. It came within the sphere of influence of Jupiter's gravity. And it grabbed it and it scattered it. It perturbed its orbit. It knocked it pretty hard. No collision took place, but there was a powerful, relatively powerful gravitational interaction, and the orbit was deflected. And you can see the new orbit. Since 1974, this comet now travels between Jupiter and Mars. There's something I'd like to point out about this orbit. This comet will continue to visit the planet that most recently scattered it until something happens to it. Another planet scatters it, it crashes into something, or vaporizes to nothing. However, until another planet grabs it or it vaporizes to nothing, this comet will continue on that orbit, and that orbit brings it to Jupiter, the orbit of Jupiter, not Jupiter itself, but the orbit of Jupiter. And on a more or less random basis, Jupiter may be there, right, to scatter it again or not. But this relates to the probability of being whacked by either an asteroid or a comet. You know, just because you miss it the first time doesn't mean the orbit's perturbed since, right? And that guy goes on the same orbit, and it comes right around and visits. It's a beautiful orbit. Jeremy, I don't think I'm going to show the graphic. Thanks. It's a beautiful orbit. It's an elliptical orbit. It comes right around. It visits that same location. And guess what? Jupiter in its orbit comes and visits the same location. Now, they may not see each other simultaneously for a long time. They may not pass close to each other for a long time. Probability is, you know, you're going to have near visits and far visits. And that's one of the hazards of this business. If an asteroid or a comet misses the Earth and it's a near miss, you know, you go, whew, I won't have to worry about that again, but your grandchildren might. It's one of those quirky things. Just to summarize here, the fate of comets. This is the consensus view. They can be scattered out of the solar system, right? A perturbed orbit doesn't need to form, right, an ellipse with the sun. It could be perturbed so violently that it's just knocked out of the solar system completely. You know, it's liberated from the influence of the sun. It doesn't orbit the sun anymore. It's lost, or it goes, well, it's lost. Most of the comets that visit us that we can see suffer that fate. That's nice. It can be scattered into a stable orbit. Comet Halley is one of those. It's tilted out of the orbit where all the planets, or out of the plane where all the planets orbit. It's called the ecliptic. All the planets more or less move in the same plane. And if you knock a comet such that it's tilted out of this orbit, it doesn't come and see many planets very often. And somehow or other, Comet Halley is one of these. For about 3,000 years that we know of, it's been orbiting at a place that doesn't bring it close to whatever put it out there, and it's not particularly hazardous right now, at least, to us, despite the fact that the meteor showers it produces do hit us. Right? Here we see the disintegration of Shoemaker-Levy. This is 1994. I'm afraid it's an artist's rendering, but it could have happened this way. What happened was that the comet got close to Jupiter, and the gravitational forces of Jupiter pulled this wispy thing apart. Now, some of those 22 or 23 pieces that you see there are 2 kilometers across, you know, close to a mile. Anyway, it strung them out like pearls. And then they all crashed into Jupiter. Some particulars, Comet Halley. When we flew by, 1986. We got through most of the atmosphere. And this is a pretty good picture, by the way, for what you're seeing. What we found was that Comet Halley is a lot bigger than we thought. The nucleus is a lot bigger than we thought, this ball of ice. It's, quote, shaped like a potato. It seems that everything we fly by is shaped like a potato. And what you see here on the sunward side are the jets. Okay. I'll keep turning to the right. What we see coming off are the jets.
I'll turn it down a little bit.
Okay. What we see coming off are the jets. The guys who do the imaging mathematics of these sorts of pictures see these amorphous representations from all kinds of different tilts, and they can extract a huge amount of fine structure. And what they find is there are 5, 10, 15 small jets. Sometimes they converge and produce effectively a large jet. What they also do is image the surface of this thing, and what they find on the surface is the following, and pardon me for reading this. Activity, that is spewing of dust and gas, is confined to the sunlit side of the nucleus. As soon as the nucleus, which is rotating, revolves into its own shadow, it rotates into its own shadow, all of a sudden, activity stops. The sunlight drives this stuff. Most of the activity appears to originate from discrete sources in the form of jets. Up to 5 jets are observable at one time. Some have multiple components, that is, small jets combined to form a large jet. Individual jet output is intermittent and varied on a time scale of several hours. Got a bunch of stuff up here that's pretty hard to explain. What's going on in an ice ball that will do this? An active area about 3 kilometers in diameter contains scalloped areas resembling impact craters 500 meters across. It's going to be very hard to get that in a snowball, and I'll explain that in a little bit. Larger jets recorded on photographic plates in 1910 apparition have evidently persisted. That is, if there's a scalloped area that looks like an impact crater and it's got a jet coming out of it, evidence for that jet appeared in photographic film, right, plates produced in 1910 from telescopes here on Earth. Nobody could be sure what they were looking at the time. But when we match these photos with those historic photos, we're seeing much of the same jet structure. So there's a persistence of this phenomenon, whatever it is. Below is a flyby comet Borelli, year 2000, another potato. And you can see on the right, after long exposure, the jet structure, which isn't immediately available, apparent. So the image on the right, as far as the potato is concerned, is overexposed. But it reveals the structure of the jets. And some good soul counted 3 of them. But as I say, the basis for the count is not this film, but many, many more that are imaged properly, very cleverly. End quote. The 3 jets of dust are thought to emanate from deep well-like structures in bowl-shaped depressions in the nucleus. These are regions of active erosion. This is how this stuff gets out. It just doesn't sublime off the surface. The surface is dark. The reflectivity of this, or the geometrical albedo, is about 0.04. 4% of the light that gets in is reflected back. And for the 2 we've observed up close, except for the most recent one, within the last 3 months or so, these first two out of 3 are just simply dark, covered with black stuff, inactive, except for the jets. And stuff in the associated areas. Now, what I'd like to do is to tell you a little bit about small comets. They differ from the large comets. A guy named Lewis Frank and his associates, University of Iowa, he was a darling of NASA. He was an experimentalist. He was great. He flew experiments on satellites. He built them and flew them. And what he saw when he looked down on the Earth, the sunlit side, right, was all that ultraviolet radiation coming in. With a special UV camera, he could see the ultraviolet coming in, hitting the oxygen up there, making it glow. It's called the day glow. His camera was really designed to look at the aurora borealis activity at the poles, mostly the North Pole in this particular case. But he trained the camera on the overall aspect of the Earth. And what he found is in this day glow field were little spots. And these guys persisted for 3 to 5 minutes. It was regarded as noise by this team for about 2.5 years. But after trying to eliminate the noise, what they found was it wasn't camera noise, it wasn't component noise, you know, in the transmission system telemetry back to Earth. It wasn't noise. They began to believe that these comets were real. Well, the spots were real, they were physical. And it turns out that the frequency of ultraviolet was exactly the frequency absorbed by water. And their conclusion was that they have a satellite up here, they have the Earth here, they have the day glow field in between. The satellite's looking down and it's seeing these spots. And what they concluded was there was a glop of water in between, you know, that was absorbing the re-radiation from this day glow field. The water sucked it up, and what you saw was a shadow of this parcel of water. Now, the radius of the parcel was about 100 kilometers. And the amount of water they inferred was about 30 tons. Nobody objected in the scientific community. Nobody objected to this story until they said, oh, by the way, how does the water get up there for, you know, in these glops at 3 minutes, 5 minutes at a time? Well, we've got these little things called little comets, because comets are made mostly of water. The little comets come in, they break up at 150 or 1,500 kilometers above the Earth's atmosphere, right where the magnetic field is strong enough to pull charges apart and spill the guts of these comets that are very flimsy. This stuff spreads out, you know, as it hits the... And by the time it's at 250 kilometers, the diameter of the glop is expanded to, you know, about 100 kilometers. And he says, that's what we're seeing. They're from little comets. Nobody liked that. I'll tell you why. Because the rate at which they arrive in the atmosphere is about, according to Lewis Frank and colleagues, is about 30 per minute. 30 per minute. And that's 30 tons per arrival. And if you multiply that out over 4 billion years, it's enough water to fill the oceans. And he looked crazy. Just nuts. And they were willing to concede it could be 10 billion times fewer per day or per hour, 10 billion times fewer. But this was ridiculous. And Lewis Frank took a lot of heat for this. He's not a well-loved man. I like him, but in this particular, so in his lifetime, he's had the burden of having to prove himself. Not that the water's there, not that the water comes from somewhere, but it comes from little comets. I don't see the problem, to tell you the truth, but there may be some things that need to be clarified. What he did was to go to University of Arizona, or at least the site of University of Arizona. He got the help of some of his colleagues. There have been numbers, a major fly of a satellite, I think 1994, that had three independent instruments on it to confirm what he saw with the instrument earlier to do the aurora borealis study. He got confirmation. Still think it's noise. The community still thinks it's noise. So what he did was to go and get a ground-based telescope and do what they call skeet shooting, right? They know just about how these comets have to come in, their orbit relative to the Earth. And so what he did was to take the barrel, so to speak, of this telescope, right, and pan across the sky, you know, after sunset or before sunrise, pan across the sky, focus on a distance just before these comets disintegrate, and see if he gets anything. And these are only 30 tons, you know, relative to the moon. This is a small, small object. And he gets results. But I want to tell you how tough it is to convince anybody with the results he got. He got a number of results, and maybe you can see the small yellow box. I don't mean the big yellow box. I mean the small yellow box. And from the upper left to the lower right, you see three little spots in a row. What they do is, in effect, strobe the acquisition of the image. Now, the streaks are stars. And as he's panning along, he's exposing the film, so to speak. And so one star, right, in this field, the moving film, it comes in as a streak. So when you see something stationary, right, it's the thing that's moving across the sky corresponding to the rate at which you're panning. It's like skeet shooting, right? You acquire, the target, right, the dove or the pigeon, clay pigeon, whatever they're called, right? Right, in the sights, and you can continually see it, spot it, through the sights, but it's moving across the sky. You think it's still relative to the film in this particular camera. And that's what the 3 points in a row mean. Now, that looks like background noise to me, but I've read his paper. It's exquisitely written. This little junk up here, the 3 spots in a row, that's something. But the battle rages. So, on the presumption that what Louis Frank has here is something, I did a calculation. I'll be brief with this technical portion. In order to do a calculation, you have to buy into a certain theory. This is a distribution theory for where the comets are. Now, the current theory, which I don't like, I think I've got a substitute, but I can't talk about it here. The current theory is that, these comets are coming in from the Oort cloud, the planet, especially Jupiter, grab them, perturb their orbit, and capture them so they don't wander far from the inner solar system, that is, the interplanetary region. And this is called a scatter diagram, right? You have comets, for example, and you want to draw a picture of comets so that the theoreticians don't have to stand outside and look in the sky all the time. They can see some spots on a graph paper, and it's much more convenient that way. So the way you do it is to say, here's a comet. It's got an elliptic orbit. The little q down there is the perihelion distance, the closest it comes to the sun. And the big q up there on the vertical axis is the aphelion, the farthest it gets from the sun. And so we make 2 points, right, in these Cartesian coordinate systems, shortest distance, longest distance, and we plot the point. That's the geometry of the statistics of where the heck these comets are. I'm putting up this for just one purpose, and that is to say, look, the interpretation of this is that for these comets that we see over and over, these short period comets, the question is, how far out are they? Maximum distance. We look vertically, and we see that they're all kind of bunched up around 5.2 astronomical units. That's Jupiter. These guys are getting out toward Jupiter, but most of them are not much farther from Jupiter. And to find out how close they come in, you can see they're distributed, if you look horizontally, the little q, between, let's say, 3 and 1. Well, what's between 3 and 1? Asteroids and Earth. So the farthest out they get tends to be Jupiter. They bunch up there. And the closest in they get is somewhere between Earth and the asteroids. And they have this kind of distribution in the inner solar system. Now, getting close to Jupiter is hazardous for us because if they haven't hit us, Jupiter keeps reloading the gun, perturbing the orbit. And they may hit us next time, or maybe get thrown out completely. These are unstable, these short-period comets. Now, I haven't proved that, but you can make a good argument for it. The other question is, well, where are they with regard to not just close in or far out, but their tilt? All the planets move in this ecliptic plane. If they're tilted, right, they don't get close to the planets very often, at least. They don't cohabitate throughout their orbits. How much are they tilted? Well, I've got another scatter plot here, and it doesn't matter what the horizontal axis is. This just tells you the inclination. That is the amount the planet or the comet's orbit is tilted. Now, the only reason I'm showing you this is because, you know, the tilt isn't very much. They tend to hang out near the planets. That is, the planets are like moving here, and the tilt is at most, let's say 35 or 40 degrees for most of these guys, except for one. It's called a retrograde orbit. It's tilted so much, you know, everything's going clockwise in this scheme, but when you tilt it 160 degrees, right, it's going counterclockwise, right? And what's the guy out here? Halley's Comet. This guy is exceptional. Now, I haven't plotted all the points, but I just wanted to make a point. This comet's exceptional, and it's not gone dead. It's been bright for about 3,000 years. I think the best estimate is 2,540 or something like that, and then people are willing to stretch it a bit, and they say, well, maybe, you know, the Chinese saw it earlier, and there may be some evidence for that. It's been active much longer. Hold that thought. So, why show you this? Because the little comets and the big comets are supposed to, in the consensus view, come from the same place. And therefore, they have the same orbit population. So when I do my calculation, Comet Halley's coming in on this orbit, retrograde, going the wrong direction. It's like driving on city traffic in the wrong lane. All right? I'll come back to that. Comet Borelli, it's driving in the right lane. It's prograde. The question is, how frequently did the little guys hit the big guys? Well, you need a model for where the little guys are, and that's why I'm summarizing these orbit statistics. Because the little guys and the big guys are supposed to be coming from the same place, therefore they have the same statistics. First result I'd like to present. The expected impact velocity when the little guys hit the big guys, somewhere for Comet Borelli, which is going with the traffic, 16 kilometers a second. That's pretty fast. For Comet Halley, 41.2 kilometers a second. I've done the statistics wrong, and this is an underestimate. It's like 92,000 miles per hour for Comet Halley. That's really fast. And only 37,000 miles an hour. Now, this is the rate at which these guys tend to hit each other, the average rate at which the little guys hit the big guys. That's really fast. It's a lot of energy, and it's going to make a hole, even if it's only 30 tons. I've done further calculations. This is the conventional view of impact dynamics. I'd like to make, without going into the details here, when one hard thing made out of basalt or granite or iron hits another hard thing made out of the same hard stuff, similarly hard stuff, what happens is, with these hypervelocity impacts that exceed the speed of sound, what sound, you may say? Well, the speed of sound in the material. These are going so much faster than that. It's like a plane exceeding the speed of sound in air. Something's different around the wing. Well, something's different when these two guys crash. First of all, the projectile vaporizes. It's gone. And it sends out a shock wave in the target. And it's called a detached shock. And that means that when the shock goes through, it compresses the material and moves it forward a little bit. But trailing behind it is called a rarefaction wave or a release wave, and the stuff that's all bunched up doesn't want to be bunched up at the back. There's nothing enforcing this compression, and so it springs back. It doesn't spring back efficiently. This shock wave is violent, and it changes things. It changes them, you know, chemically. It changes crystalline structure. It fractures the thing. It melts it. It vaporizes it. All depends. But it changes it so that when it's decompressing or released, it doesn't restore to its original state. And part of that's reflected in the fact that it doesn't spring back completely to the standing still state it had before it was shocked. There's a residual velocity that it hasn't quite compensated for by springing back completely. And that residual velocity causes an excavation. Now, the original projectile is gone, and the excavation that results is about 30 times bigger than the projectile. And they're all round. Even those coming in sideways, right? You look at the craters on the moon, people used to think they're volcanoes. They're not. They said they're volcanoes because they're round. Impact craters would be oblong because the guys that come in low create, you know, elliptical craters. That's not true. These guys are all round. Not only that, the compression wave, right, the shock wave that comes down like this, it really smashes stuff hard. But it's got no way to go out. I mean, which direction does it choose? The excavation doesn't carry it away. So what happens is that stuff's compressed hard and it rebounds up again. It's got no choice. And the rebound produces features such as islands in the craters. The rebound stuff forms an island that just pops up there. Right? It gets a little enthusiastic. I've had to rework this theory with regard to porous objects hitting other porous objects. Instead of a rebound, what happens is there's a core of material that keeps going forward because the porous stuff doesn't compress well enough to rebound. Instead of having an island, you have a hole in the ground. So you've got this lovely crater, and then you have a shaft or a well. And that's exactly what we see in Comet Halley and Comet Borelli. The third thing I'd like to tell you, rushing through like crazy, the third thing I'd like to tell you is the calculations I've done put these craters at the wrong size. Instead of 500 meters, which we observe, we get closer to 50 meters or 100 meters. We're only off by a factor of 5 or 10. What happens is we produce an impact crater like so. We produce a shaft like so. That's not the end of the story. The comets, although they're getting solar radiation, are still not active. But the energy underneath modifies the substructure underneath this dark mantle. It, in particular, vaporizes gases and gives them an opportunity to escape through the shaft. And that's how we get the geysers. How do we get cyclic geysers? The solar energy vaporizes gases. They find an outlet underneath. And what happens is the gases are laden with water vapor. When the gases are subducted around this crater wall, it's cold. Ice condenses. The flow is obstructed. It slows down. The nature of the gas changes here. If the flow is shorter, it turns out it picks up less water vapor. So it gets hotter and drier. So when the flow is obstructed, the residual flow is less, but it's hotter and drier. It evaporates the ice, restores the porousness, restores the potential for flow. The system cranks up again, but then the gas isn't dry anymore. It gets wet. So you have condensation of ice, evaporation of ice in this cold region here, and you have a cyclic behavior imposed on the jets themselves. I think there's an explanation for what we see in comets with regard to how they disintegrate. It's a revision of the consensus theory. It explains a heck of a lot. I've listed the number of things that are explained here that I'm satisfied are explained. And I'd like to revisit the life cycle of comets. What happens to them now in the revised view? They could be scattered out of the solar system. Doesn't matter if the stuff's coming off in jets or not. They could be lost. That's a good deal. They could be scattered into stable orbits. such as Halley's Comet, that's not near because of the tilt, it's not near anything very often. They could vaporize to nothingness. I don't believe that anymore. So this pathway for elimination is gone. I think they vaporize to a small size. They cease to be hit anymore because they're small targets. There are other things going on there as well. Collision with permanent members of the solar system? Earth. I think because the vaporization is gone, I'll bet a quarter on that, it's more likely they'll hit the Earth. But what hits the Earth? Not rocks like Tunguska. These things are just filled with methane, carbon dioxide, water, explode in the atmosphere. The hazard may be more frequent, but not as severe. Sorry to rush through. That's all I got.